Welcome back to Dare to Feel. I'm your host, Alexandra Roxo, creative artist, best-selling author of Fuck Like a Goddess, transformational and spiritual mentor and coach. This series is based on my latest book, Dare to Feel. In each episode, we'll deepen into topics around intimacy, relationships, spirituality, healing, and beyond. In today's episode, we're speaking with Marissa Meltzer, who's an author and a writer. We're talking about wellness trends, controversy in the wellness and spirituality world, being a woman today on a healing journey and quest, and trends in general with women who are public figures. It is a really good conversation, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. So good to be in your ears today. So I have Marissa Meltzer. She is a writer based in New York City. Her latest book, Glossy, The Inside Story of Emily Weiss's Glossier, is out now. She writes for The New York Times, New Yorker, The Guardian, Vanity Fair, New York Magazine, and Vogue. She's also written many other books, and she is working on a book right now, and she is joining us live from Paris, where she's researching Jane Birkin. So I just want to add that in for a little bit of, just flair here. Welcome. So happy to see you.
I'm so glad to see you too.
Yeah. Okay. So I encountered your work when you wrote or when you published the infamous article about the Spirit Weavers Gathering. Did you know I was going to ask you this first?
No, but I love talking about it.
So for you guys listening, I don't know, probably you've heard of Spirit Weavers, but maybe not all of you. Back in
what year was it, like 2016?
Yeah, it was 2016.
2017? Okay.
I think it was 2016. I was sort of making my transition from film and TV into wellness. I had heard about Spirit Weavers. I hadn't thought to go or anything like that. But I remember I had a real good friend, she will remain anonymous, but who was a part of that community. And she's actually like a queer Brooklyn friend. So I knew her from like this very hip, artsy, queer Brooklyn scene. But she also was a part of Spirit Weavers, and maybe still is. And I remember her just shouting on social media about the fact that this journalist had gone to Spirit Weavers undercover and written this expose. So because we're going to talk today about women, wellness, like what's real, what's not, what heals, what doesn't, et cetera, and also why you write about women, just to give you guys a little bit of a preview, what made you want to write that? How did you have the audacity to do that? And what happened after?
Okay. So I, like you had just kind of heard about it. I think that I had an acquaintance who had gone maybe to like one of the first ones or something and had just kind of mentioned that it was kind of wild. And I really wanted to write about it. Mostly like as a reason to go, but also I just knew that there was going to be a lot to process. I had no idea.
And why did you know? I'm so curious.
It just felt very like the most sort of like, you know, white lady, off the grid wellness, getting into sort of like, out there territory. And, you know, from my background, I grew up in California in Santa Cruz. So I was definitely, and one of the reasons why I'd written so much about beauty and wellness was because of my background. Like wellness was coming up through more mainstream channels and editors would assign me stories about it because I wouldn't just write something that was like, ew, acupuncture, weird, needles, you know, that all of that, like I had gotten acupuncture in the early 80s as a kid and my parents drank green juice, you know, my whole life. And so all of that was kind of normal enough to me, but I didn't, you know, it's not, even though I knew people who grew up in like intentional communities and went to Waldorf schools, I wasn't quite that, you know, end of things, but I was very familiar with those worlds. And so Spirit Weavers, I think, reminded me of some of those areas, and also just that kind of edge of like where my boundary is of like wellness and I don't know, like alternative lifestyles and, you know, all of that, like where that might be. I just had a feeling.
I'm an interrupter because I like, do you remember, please. I like to grab details. Do you remember how much the ticket cost by chance, or like to go there, how much you spent to go there? I can't remember, but I think it was quite expensive. It was not. No?
Yeah. It was a couple $100s.
Oh, okay.
Maybe a little more.
Okay. Maybe the price went up the years that I looked later.
Maybe it was like $500 or something. Okay. Although, to be fair, you didn't really get that much for the money because you do have to bring your own camping equipment and stuff like that. I guess it's for the like workshops and food. Maybe it was more than that. Maybe it was like $1,200. I'm really
blanking. Anyway, somebody will Google it later and let us know.
Also, so part of why I was able to go is I had like mentioned it to a friend who was an editor over the years, and she was, you know, finally in a position where she could assign me to do it. And I tried to go the normal route of like, hi, I wanted to come as press to cover it. And they were like, no. And then and tickets were sold out. And so I put myself on some kind of waiting list or something. And a few months later got an email that there was like a ticket available. And I emailed my editor and said, do you still want to do this? I can buy a ticket and just go. And, you know, are you comfortable with that? And she said, yeah, of course, it's open to the public. Go and, you know, write about your experience. So I bought a ticket and it was kind of last minute. I think that it was happening like a week or two later or something like that. And it wasn't so much that I was undercover, but it was more just like traditionally, if you were working with, you know, someone, you would organize interviews with, you know, the people that led it or, you know, something right. like this. And this was more like I was just going as a normal camper, spirit weaver. And it was definitely intense. I mean, I think what I saw about it was, yeah, there was a certain level where you could kind of laugh at just the like aesthetics of it. But also there was just parts of it. And I think some of it didn't even make the final cut that just felt irresponsible. Like there were these drum, like you could like cure hides to like make a drum workshop. And, you know, someone like slice their finger and they're still having them work with like hide and, you know, all this stuff that's like, oh, they should go to a doctor and get like some injections of something so that they don't have like a crazy infection. Like just stuff where it was like, ooh, this doesn't seem great. Or like, you know, just so many, there was one point where like they had all these women singing like these sort of like slave spirituals walking to the river, and they're beautiful songs, but it was sort of alarming to see all of these women wearing silk, mostly, you know, white, presenting and probably middle class and above, you know, singing songs like about, you know, working, you know, sort of written by slaves. And it just felt like there was just a lot of casual appropriation and misappropriation, and kind of just, there was just this kind of like bossy mean girls aspect of it too, of like, it felt like there were people that were kind of inner circle and outer circle, and you know, everything that's weird about groups of people that come
especially
together,
women
especially
gathering.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I've been to other, girl. I've been to other, plenty of other sort of like women centric, spaces. And anyway, so, but you know, I wrote it not even thinking it was so much of like a takedown, but just this kind of like funny and smart and look into this thing that most people didn't know about and, you know, might not care about. And then it went like hugely viral in a way that really surprised me. And I have never got, I mean, the followers or just the fans or whatever were so angry. I've never gotten more hate mail in my life. And, you know, blocked.
These were from like wellness people sending hate mail, actual hate mail, or was it like, let's repair?
I mean, there was some of that. There were some people, but that's the thing. I think it was mostly angry because I can remember some of the ones that felt a little more thoughtful, you know,
yeah.
Like someone was like, oh, you made some good points about like, they give you tiny portions of food. And like, once I got caught trying to get more and got publicly shamed for it. And someone wrote me saying that she totally agreed with that part, but felt like I was kind of shitting on women and, you know, it was right. A low blow. And she had been like a leader of a group there or like a workshop. And, you know, that to me is more of an interesting dialogue where it's like, you know, like, I see what you're trying to do. Like, let's talk about it. And then, yeah. But most of it was just people who just felt betrayed. Like some people were people I had like met in real life who then never spoke to me again or blocked me or whatever. And it's very, you know, intense where people are like that angry at you. People got angry, like looked up who the editor was and would like, you know, send hate mail to her and stuff like that. So it was intense, but wonderful because there was also a lot of people that, you know, really loved it and all of that. But yeah, it lives on in infamy.
It lives on. And it's like, I think that you brought these pieces to a conversation about white women in wellness that people hadn't been thinking about or at least talking about or at least publishing mm-hmm. or writing about. And I think it's interesting because there's a parallel with this and kind of your exploration into Emily Weiss and like, you know, the mm-hmm. girl boss culture and whatever. It's being able to see you as a writer and kind of almost like forecast like something that is going to be taken down or does need to be looked at a little bit more closely. So I think that that's interesting because I think so many people in wellness in, you know, 2020 got really scrubbed and, you know, put under a magnifying glass. And so that's interesting that piece came out in 2016 before people were really like, super aware of cultural appropriation or, you know, whatever, creating diversity in space, which is terrible.
Yeah. And it's, I'm not, I'm, a, you know, I am a white woman. It's not like,
yeah, I know it wasn't
I pretend to be an expert on that. But I also, for me, I think it's more interesting to think about, I think so much of the wellness world and what Spirit Weavers is trying to do in a broad sense is like hold people and institutions accountable, like let's make the world better. Let's fix, you know, the healthcare system. Let's learn to love each other. Let's, you know, like call people out or in or, you know, have dialogues about things. And so I think that what felt surprising to me was that when I, you know, brought up some like glaring, valid criticisms of, you know, this place that they just were not at least willing to me. Who knows if they had any kind of internal, you know, dialogue that was real, but instead it was just extremely defensive. And yeah, I think that it's important if you're going to try to change things and, you know, disrupt things as Glossier did, or like, you know, you're trying to change culture in any way, you know, you have to also, you know, hold that same mirror up to yourself, or at least, you know, be willing to, you know, change and accept criticism and try to get better. I mean, I know that's something I'm constantly trying to do to myself. It's not necessarily fun or easy all the time, but it's essential, I think. Yeah. And so, you know, but then when you're working on projects like this and you, you know, interface with people who seem very reluctant to do that, you know.
Yeah. I noticed that, I don't know if it was the Instagram post that you had made, but in the Harper's Bazaar article, they're now like taken down. Did you end up taking those posts down because they had so many crazy comments on them?
No, I didn't even know. I think that it's probably something more anodyne, like they switch servers you know, like it's probably something very, you know, basic like that, but who knows?
Well, so, you know, on the flip side of that, so that was a big, I think, that created some sort of a ripple, I think, in the wellness space with women. I think that it did. I think that I heard about it. I never heard about, like, I didn't know Spirit Weavers at that time, but, and I think that that conversation continued to open. So anyway, it was a powerful piece and it brought some things to light. And I've also seen and experienced you on the flip side, writing some really supportive pieces about women. I did a session with you back, and I guess that was 2018. You wrote about me. It was very touching, and I felt very grateful. Oh, I probably felt really scared also because I thought, man, she wrote that thing about Spirit Weavers. Is she going to come in here and be like,
it's hard to be written about, you know, I've been on both sides of it. I totally understand. It's not, you know, it's scary and, but yeah, I don't try to go in and make people look bad, but I'm not there to like, I'm not writing a press release for people either. No. So I just try to go with everything of like, this is what it feels like to be in this person's presence, or this is what it feels like to go here and do this thing for me. And I'm going to try to make you feel what it feels like to be there as well.
Yeah. So that's a great distinction to consider. It's like part of your career in writing for these different outlets has been, let's say, investigating. And I'm curious about this piece. What of your own healing journey, or what has drawn you to, let's say, doing a session with me or with Deborah Hanekamp, or going to Spirit Weavers? There must be. You know, you mentioned that you grew up with some green juice and acupuncture and that kind of thing, but there must be something that has continued to bring you into those spaces, which are not for everybody and could be a little bit weird, a little bit woo-woo, a little bit, you know, kind of out there, or just vulnerable for you as a writer to put yourself like in the presence of a healer or a coach or a modality or a group of women in the woods. So what's that for you? What's the why underneath that keeps you doing it? And then the second part of this question is then sharing that publicly. Cause like that's, it's not like you're going on a healing quest just for you. You're committing and your integrity as a writer to then sharing about that. And maybe it's not the details of your journey, but it is still, I mean, quite vulnerable to tell the world, hey, I'm on this quest.
I think that, well, I think I'll answer the second part first, which is that I always feel like if I'm writing about something honestly, then that feels, I don't know, right for me or something, but also I'm deciding what to share. Like, I'm not like just live streaming my life or something like that. Like, I'm not really an exhibitionist. I wouldn't say I'm overly private, but it's like if I'm very, you know, it's the same thing when I do interviews and people will ask me sometimes if there's something I don't want to talk about. And A, if I don't want to talk about something, I'm not going to like point it out to you. But also I say, you know, I'm a big girl. Like if I don't want to talk about something, I'm very adept at saying, I don't want to talk about that or changing the subject or whatever. And, you know, so I would say that there are probably things that I don't talk about. There are probably things I barely even talk about with my therapist, you know, that I'm still working on. So it's like everything, you pick and choose what you want to share with the world. But then, yeah, I think that I'm always one of those people that I certainly like to dabble and experiment. You know, I didn't grow up religious. And so I think there's a little part of me that's like looking for that kind of faith or, you know, some kind of substitution. But then also, I think there's just part of me that always has a little bit of hope that I'm going to find the thing that fixes everything, you know, right. That you're just like, maybe I'm very vulnerable to like a cult leader in that way, or I'm going to be the star of like the next HBO thing. But, you know, there is something very tempting where someone is like, oh, I got my, you know, TM mantra and I do that every day and it changed my life. And like, I have gotten my TM mantra and I do like it, but it's like, I've never found the thing where it's like this right. one person or this one thing changed everything, which is probably good because I think that you probably need to do a lot of different things in order to, you know, change yourself and tune in and all of that. But yeah, I think that like a little bit of that promise is exciting to me that mm-hmm. I'll stumble onto the person or the world or the something that fixes me. And, you know, I'm smart enough to know that that doesn't really exist, but I'm naive enough to think that like, you know, the next thing could be the one.
What's the thing that needs fixing?
I mean, I would actually do almost anything that could fix my insomnia. I've had it since I was like my whole life, like even wow. as a kid. And I'm terrible at sleeping. And so that would like anything anyone flings at me, Western, Eastern, whatever, mind, body, I've tried it all. And I would continue to do literally anything. I'll buy any tincture. Wow. So that's more on like a, like yeah. that would change my life just in terms of like fuzz in the head and, you know, yeah. all of that. Although I think I manage it well, because
you're writing all these books and using your brain quite well.
I take naps. I make up for it. I've gotten yes. better at it. Actually, I think podcasts have helped because I listen to certain kind of like boring, but sleepy podcasts that like help lull me back to sleep better than, you know, like looking at the internet or whatever I used to. Yeah. But then what else? I don't know what's underneath it. I mean, I'm kind of like, I'm a very social person, but I'm also kind of like a lonely solo person. My parents are divorced and I'm not on bad terms with them, but I'm not like overly close to my family. I'm an only child. I live on the other side of the country from them and have for like over 20 years. And I've certainly been in long relationships, but I've never been married. I've never wanted kids. And so I think there's part of me that like is a little bit maybe like alone in this world on kind of like in an existential way that maybe wants to understand like that, and also is maybe trying to like engage with community, mm-hmm. like tiptoe towards it or something, yeah. but that also scares me or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
It's all like, yeah. 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 It's like, you know, I think we're all trying to like put ourselves into context or something or understand it.
Of course. I can resonate with like everything you said, only child, parents, this, you know, like.
Yeah. You and I are both like deeply yeah. that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just had a baby, so things are definitely changing. And
do you think you'll have more than one?
God, it's so weird. I was like, hell no. And then you look at this thing and I'm like, I want more. It's creepy.
Do you really? Yeah. It's all over the place. I know people who had one and was like, I thought I wanted more and I absolutely don't.
But I think it's a biological thing. Like it's a freak mm-hmm. biology that, because I can just feel that, and, you know, but I financially and time-wise, I feel like we need to be making much more money, because I just feel yeah. like people become more and more stressed out the more kids they have, especially depending on so many factors, you know, if you have family,
especially in society, you know, like I'm in Paris right now, and like you can send your kids to like free preschool and have way more, you know, free time to yourself that you don't have to pay for. It's just not the same.
Yeah. America. And I think I thought, and I, this is vulnerable on my side, but I think I thought that having a child would sort of solve my existential aloneness, you know,
because I still have time. You're a new mom. I know. You can just put all that pressure on your baby to solve all of that. Don't worry about it. It can
happen. What I'm dealing with, but we can talk about that off record. But I think, you know, I'm also smart enough to know that like my relationship did not solve. My being in a relationship did not solve that existential kind of deep illness. And I do think it's interesting that that this kind of search for meaning or search for some sort of missing link exists in all of us. And some people place that on top of money or appearance or whatever. And they just go so hard thinking that that's going to solve the thing. And that's going to fill the hole. I guess like Anne Lamott calls it the God-shaped hole, you know, which I love
her. Yeah, sure. Yeah, or like Joan Didion says, like, we tell ourselves stories in order to live, you know, like same kind of idea, right?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's something beautiful to, and this is just because I've also made a similar choice, so I can look at it in this way, but to looking to, instead of just filling it with money or sex or booze or ambition or whatever, to keeping open the possibility that there is healing, or like keeping that opening alive. And even if the healing comes and goes, right? Like maybe you do have a beautiful session or experience or something that kind of opens your heart just a little bit more for a week, right? I mean, I was going to ask you, kind of as a joke, like what drugs have you tried, when you were like, I've tried everything. Just because I do think nowadays the psychedelic.
Yeah, I think I've tried most of them.
Yeah.
I mean, except for like heroin. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard it's great, but I will not try it this lifetime.
Yeah. No. I think there's a reason why I've stayed away. But no, I think all the psychedelic ones, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, weirdly, I don't think I've ever done acid. But I've done every other psychedelic
you've
drug.
You've got time.
I've had time. Yeah, I know.
But that is a piece I think that a lot of people nowadays are sort of evangelizing, which we won't talk about much more, people, because this isn't what this podcast is about today. But I think people are evangelizing that psychedelics, ketamine, psilocybin, you know, all of this can be some sort of a balm for that.
Internal. Yeah, for me, it's not so much that it's been a balm, but it's been like, it's like taking a shot of espresso or something. Like it like supercharges that surge. Like the times, you know, the like joke about ayahuasca that it's like 10 years of therapy or something in one night is to me not untrue. Like it definitely feels like it just gives you. But for me, it's more like it just gives you tons of stuff to be like, here's your homework for the next, you know, 10 years or whatever. Like, here's everything you need to work on. You know, now it's very clear and you know it. And so,
I agree. I agree with that. And I think I wish more people understood that. That's also just our reality or experience of it. But I do think that people often think that the ayahuasca itself does the homework, but it brings it all to light. Like, hey, look at this, 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 look at this. And then you're like,
And some of those insights that it's like pointing you towards can be very healing. But I think it's more like, it's like giving you a tour of everything that you need to look at. And some of it might be like, oh, this is better than I thought it was. Or like, here's something that makes me understand this relationship better or something. But most of the time, it's just more like a big download or a checklist or something.
Yeah, I agree. Quick little pause here. I want to introduce you to Groovy. They make non-alcoholic social beverages. They are award-winning for their craft beer and wine. We had their delicious dry Secco at the Dare to Fuel book launch party at Contact Sports in New York City. It was delicious, perfect for a toast when you are feeling like going alcohol-free. You can buy Groovy at Whole Foods, Target, Total Wine, and more. All right, back into the podcast. So there's more that I want to ask you about healing and wellness, but I do want to touch on, and I'll circle back around. I do want to touch on your book, Glossy, and what has drawn you to just profiling women in general and the choices you've made. Like, I love that you're making the choice to write about Jane Birkin because she's, you know, she was just so iconic. Writing about Emily Weiss, what drew you to her? And for you guys listening who maybe are less in the beauty world, she created this, or she had this blog, Into the Gloss, which I do remember. And then she created this makeup company that was very zeitgeist, like trendy, big thing. Still out there, but she's no longer CEO, right?
She's no longer CEO. Yeah.
So between her, you wrote about the founder of Weight Watchers, which I used to go to Weight Watchers with my mom as a kid in Georgia. gosh, I remember that. That spray margarine we had.
Oh my God. Like, yes.
All the fat-free stuff.
So gross. I know. I mean, just boxes of Snackwell's cookies were in my life.
God. Yeah, we had those. So many of those.
They were so good and so disgusting. So dry.
So dry. Anyway, but, and so what made you choose to write about Emily Weiss and this kind of girl boss and the fall of the girl boss and this, again, this kind of cultural trend with women that defined so much of how women started showing up, not just these, these women like Emily Weiss, but all of the followers on the internet who are like, I want to be a girl boss. So I'm going to like go out there and be the CEO of my Instagram. Yeah, I mean, that's how I see it. It's just like,
I think you're right. It was a very weird, it was an odd time. I think that, I think in general, I'm just kind of obsessed with women that are emblematic or like caught up in a moment, you know, the way that like Jane Birkin is with the 70s in Paris and, you know, 60s New York is with Weight Watchers and, you know, 2010s. New York is with Glossier. And I think I was just obsessed with all of these things. I'm definitely a person like, you know, probably most people that gets obsessed with topics. And because I'm a writer, I thought, you know, there's a book somewhere in this where you have this kind of power of the beauty industry that for so long had been kind of like the skipper to the fashion industry's Barbie. Like it was, you know, this kind of like less cool, but it actually had more power and made more money and was starting to kind of have more cultural cachet. And so I wanted to talk about that. I was obsessed with VC funding, you know, the way that so many of these direct-to-consumer companies were getting funded and selling themselves and the rise of Instagram and just the way that we were thinking of what even was beautiful was changing, and the girl bosses. And in some ways, the girl boss was like the answer to some of my like feminist prayers, where it was, at least on paper, kind of exciting that young women in business were being taken seriously and were explicitly embracing feminism and, you know, wanting to be like written about in a way that was, I don't know, somewhat akin to male peers. But then just like anything, it just felt like this kind of corporatized version of liberation that was, you know, all about making money, and the people who got elevated and were written about happened to be like beautiful and thin and live in New York and LA and were socially connected. And, and also with, you know, the pandemic and all of these things, it just was, it was one of those eras that even though you know, it was maybe like 5 years ago now, it feels like an entirely different time culturally. So it felt like there was just a lot to say about it and that it was okay to do it kind of right away because there was a lot to process. Yeah. And so I just realized eventually that I could talk about all of these things that I was interested in through the lens of Glossier, which was a brand that people understood. And so it was, you know, it was sort of a way to all of these big ideas while also telling this story of this kind of rise and kind of fall of a big brand. Not really a fall, but, you know.
What was it like to interface with Emily, this woman who you're not necessarily like, you're not putting her on a pedestal and you're not taking her off the pedestal in your book. You know, you're trying to present, like you said, when you go into any of these places, you're not going in with an agenda, it seems like, except to explore, which is awesome. And I think, you know, that's really the mark of a journalist, a journalistic writer first, right? Like you, you're coming in and we trust you. We trust that you're not just trying to be like, this person is an asshole or like this gathering is terrible, like that you are bringing this kind of objective lens to the situation. I mean, as much as possible. What was it like to interface with her? Because I found that to be some of the interesting pieces of the book. I was just like, this woman, I just,
you know, it was complex. It was really complex. Yeah. It's hard because I felt very conflicted because she, you know, she was not obligated to speak to me, but she did. But then when she did, it was, she seemed so deeply ambivalent to the point of not wanting to do it, to the point of kind of talking in circles where there's a lot of that in the book. And that's frustrating because, you know, it's like either, you know, give it, either talk to me or don't, but, you know, and so I felt like I needed to kind of dig into that in order to tell the story. And it's a little hard for me to understand because it's just not how I am and how I operate, but I also haven't built a billion-dollar company and don't have, you know, the same things, but, it's, I think, especially hard when you're a woman writing about a woman, because there is this kind of pressure to like be nice or to raise other women up. And you get into this kind of like Taylor Swift version of feminism where it's like, you're bad if you're critical of other women, which I don't agree with at all. And I, you know, had to give myself a lot of pep talks of like, well, I've written quite vulnerably about myself before, although I don't think it has to be a prerequisite that you've written about yourself to write about someone else. But I certainly have put myself under the microscope. So I had kind of a clear conscience of like, I've done this to myself. It's okay if I'm doing this to other people. But then also, you know, that what I was doing was valid, that I have a career and that's a writer and I write stories about women and that I'm interested in, you know, business and enterprise and culture and how all of those things connect, and that the story of Glossier was important one to tell, and that there aren't that many stories about women in business. And there certainly aren't ones about like contemporary companies the way that there is a gajillion about Facebook and Uber and Instagram and Elon Musk and, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried and every, you know, man in existence. And so I just had to remind myself that what I was doing was important and worthy and valid. And sometimes that was really hard, but then it helped when the book came out and had a reception, not even, it was a positive reception and that helped too, but also just that people were buying it and it sold and people were excited to read it. And it felt like it was, you know, serving like an interest. So, you know, there, it's easy when you're writing a book or doing any kind of big project and it's kind of like you pregnant alone with it, like creating this thing and, you know, sometimes you put a lot of work into things and you love it and it's not quite receive the way you want it to. And this one was really affirming because it was like, okay, all of this kind of internal, you know, drama that I had about whether or not I was being a huge asshole that's, you know, in the book, was, you know, was worth it. I was not right, but you know, that my instincts were correct.
Yeah. I just feel like it was interesting as a woman reading about less about the Glossier culture, but more about curious about Emily Weiss. I wanted so much more from her. I was like, come on, girl. Yeah. Just give us a little something. You know, I'm like, this is an opportunity to show that you're a human, not a robot. But I hear what you're saying. How can I understand that? Because I've never had a $1 billion business. And so I don't know what it's like to sort of have that amount of pressure, which would maybe keep somebody very buttoned up and very ambivalent to share. And then, but it's interesting because I'm thinking about Elon Musk or something, and I'm like, you know, obviously he is at a whole nother echelon, but thinking about some of the dudes who are just so spilly and messy and that kind of thing. And
oh, I know that there's
more pressure for the women.
I think that's part of it, is women felt like, part of the girl boss stuff was that it was a way for them to be covered as kind of serious women and not have to do the kinds of like, here's a tour of my apartment, or like some kind of like traditional way that women, even ones that were in business, were covered. And, you know, I think they wanted to be like, I answer the same kind of questions and I'm, you know, written about the same way a man would be. But I actually think in some ways that's incorrect, because look at the way that Donald Trump, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk behave, and also how they're covered by the media. It's very feminized. People are really interested in their love lives and what they wear and where they vacation. And they're very like, you know, tell all of them, you know, of themselves and stuff like that. So I actually think the way that famous men, even ones in industry, are sort of, you know, the playbook that they have right now is a little bit traditionally feminine.
Right. So it's interesting that it's like the other, let's say Emily, for instance, trying to hold maybe some standard, which actually we don't see as much.
I mean, look, everyone is entitled to not absolutely wanting to participate in something and feeling weird about it,
you know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy vulnerable. I can't imagine somebody to write a book about you or your company when you're alive, right?
Terrifying. But at the same time, you didn't create a $1 billion business yet. No. Once you do, you know, then it'll be time for someone, you know, like, I also have like, that's the thing. Like there's agency in every step here, right? Like she wasn't born into this business. She got, you know, I want to say like almost $300 million worth of funding. Every step of that path is on purpose. And so, you know, with that comes, you know, people are going to pay attention to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now, in terms of anything that you're witnessing or experiencing, I want to start with wellness, but then kind of broaden it to things that you're experiencing or witnessing out in culture about women in general. But is there anything that's inspiring you or also kind of like perplexing you that you're seeing in this sort of cultural zeitgeist right now about wellness or healing or spirituality, some of the topics that you've written about? And then we can maybe expand that to like, I don't know, business culture or fashion, whatever. But first, are you still kind of tuning into what's happening in that space?
A little bit. I mean, I'm definitely a little out of the loop just because I was so much working on Glossier and then now I'm in like Jane Birkin land. But, you know, I've been very fascinated by like the Conspirituality podcast and all of that kind of intersection between, you know, the right wing and conspiracy theories and the edges right. of the wellness world. That was something I feel so naive, but I never saw that coming. And, yeah. You know, as someone who had profiled Guru Jagat and taken plenty of classes with her and, you know, I didn't know that world so intimately, but I definitely knew it and, you know, had opinions about it. It was, you know, her death and the sort of articles about it and the upcoming documentary really fascinates me. And so, you know, all of those edges of the wellness world that are sort of, I don't know, a little dark or controversial fringy or, you know, the sort of strained bedfellows aspect of it really fascinates me. And I don't think we've seen the end of any of that.
No, I don't either. I mean, especially with all the cult documentaries, which is like a little different scale, but were there any other characters or people that you had met or known that you felt either pivoted into a different direction, like you mentioned with Guru Jagat? Anybody else that you saw, not necessarily going alt-right or becoming a QAnon person, but that you saw whose careers changed, you know, as a result of the last few years and all the different, opportunities for growth that have come forward? Anybody else who you noticed or anything else that you saw shift?
You know what? I need to think about that. Okay. I mean, I think that, you know, probably there were a lot of, I've just heard anecdotally that there were a lot of communities, whether it was like a meditation community or a yoga community, where people, you know, felt some of those divisions happening in the past few years over dialogues about everything from, you know, COVID safety to, you know, diversity to, you know, who you're voting for. And I think that not a lot of that was necessarily written about publicly, which I can understand. But also, I don't even think that people are done sort of sifting through some of their thoughts on that, you know, privately, internally. I think that there's probably a lot of communities that have really felt uprooted or divided or just had internal strife that hasn't been entirely fully processed yet.
Yeah.
I just have a few friends that I can think of that have been in ones that have dealt with, you know, like maybe there was a Me Too kind of scandal with, you know, right. someone in it or something like that. And right. I think a lot of that stuff is intense.
Yeah. And there's just been so much of it in the last few years that I've also witnessed. It's surprising. It's made me really happy that I never like, or not that I wasn't in a place to get so much scrutiny, because I'm like, I have no,
I know.
It's just terrifying. I'm like, oh, I've been a bitch to people. I've fucked up in my past. Like, I'm very glad.
Oh, I think about that a lot. I mean, there's like a woman who worked for a period underwear company who was partly kind of in a scandal. Part of it was like she would like change in front of employees. And I was just thinking, oh God, that would have absolutely been me. Like, I have really bad boundaries that way. And I definitely would have been like, you know, and people being like, you know, she'd comment on my breasts or whatever. And it was like, right. Oh God, I would have been that woman. I am, you know, just like not like forgetting that there's a difference between talking to my close friends and my employees. So,
yeah. I think it's been interesting to witness different leaders in the wellness space, or even different women like the one you're talking about, who, you know, are probably doing mostly good. And the fact that, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not condoning bad boundaries or like talking about people's bodies at all. Like, my neighbor, when I was pregnant, was like, I forgot what he said. He looked at my body and he was like, it looks like you didn't gain much weight for being pregnant, or something like that. He implied that, whatever. Right. I don't like that. My dad looked at my boobs the other day and was like, You're only going to have those right now. You know, those are very different because they're masculine, feminine context, but I don't
totally look. Most of us look terrible if we are held up to scrutiny. Right. Yeah. And like, also what is considered, you know, social mores are changing so quickly. I was rewatching that show, How to Make It in America, mm-hmm. which was an HBO show that was on just in 2010.
I remember. I didn't watch it, but I remember. Who was in it?
Brian Greenberg and Lake Bell and like sort of small New York actors. Yeah. But, you know, even though it wasn't that long ago, 2010, some of the topics feel as dated as the like, weird, like I'm wearing tights under shorts with like ankle boots kind of outfits, you know, skinny scarves and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, so I think we're just in a period of so much rapid change too over what the way we're talking about things and what is considered appropriate and thoughtful and sensitive that, you know, it's hard to keep up and it's hard to understand when people need to be told that they're being an asshole or when they need grace or, you know, all of that. I'm happy I'm not the one that has to decide all of that, but you know.
Yeah, I guess that's the cancel culture and the woke culture and that, like, how we keep up with all the different nuances of that and what's okay, what's not okay. It's a really particular time. I can't imagine trying to, like, lead a big company at this time.
Oh, so hard. Yeah,
I think that whether it's Guru Jagat or Sophia Amoruso or Audrey Gelman, her name?
Mm-hmm. From The Wing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of these women who are Mickey Agarwal, like some of these women who have been, you know, scrutinized in such big ways, I have compassion for them. It's a terrifying to try to keep.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that that's key. It's having compassion. It's not necessarily agreeing with them, but also not just throwing like tomatoes at them or, vilifying them completely, you know?
Yeah.
Also, I think it's important to realize that there's a huge range of mistakes that, you know, even just in like the girl boss that were made, like some people were kind of hard to work with and other people were actually doing criminal things. And like, there's a difference there, you know?
There's a big difference. Oh my God.
Yeah.
What is it like to, for you as an artist, as a writer, to make these moves or take these risks, if you will, that could potentially trigger and upset people? Because this is a question, I mean, this can apply to all of life, right? Not just being an artist, not just being a writer. How do we, I like returning to the word audacity, how do we have the audacity to kind of potentially ruffle feathers? Because I think a lot of people are scared. A lot of people don't want to make the mistakes that we just talked about. I really appreciate the work of Africa Brooke, who talks about self-censorship. I don't know if you follow her online. And how it's like we're in this time of self-censorship. And how are we supposed to make real art or have real conversations if we're always just like trying to color within the lines? It seems like you have had the courage to take those risks. So maybe this is a little bit more for the community listening. What helps you make those, that helps you take those risks?
I think like, you know, there are plenty of bad qualities that I have, but I would say that one good one is I'm pretty brave and I don't really like operating out of fear at all. And so if something scares me in a, you know, in a good way, then it's probably something that I need to do. You know, like, I think it's good to challenge yourself. So if something just feels scary because it feels like the unknown, it feels like a lot to do, you know, it feels outside my comfort zone. That's usually a good indication to me. I try to, you know, get more into intuition in terms of like something being like scary and a like, this is a terrible idea kind of way. But yeah. And so I think I tend to, I don't like to operate out of fear. I don't like to do something, you know, because to say no to things because I'm scared. With that comes often a lot of stress and unknown, you know, again, like you can work really hard on something and be really proud of it and get through the fear. And, you know, I wish I could say that that's enough of a reward, but it doesn't always feel that way. I think that for me, it's just working on things that make me excited and, you know, getting through the fear by feeling like I kind of did everything I can on my part. Like I researched, I interviewed everyone I could. I read everything I could. I was, you know, I talked to lawyers and made sure that I, you know, that if there was anywhere, like with the Glossier book, for example, if there was any part that felt like it was, even if it was juicy and fun in a way that felt a little gossipy, which I like my books to feel like, if it felt like it was veering into the territory of a different kind of writer or book, I just didn't go with it. Or I tried to change the language, or I just thought like, is this starting to sound sleazy? Like, am I starting to sound like a creep or an asshole? Like, that's usually an indicator that you need to dig deeper and have more commentary and analysis of a situation. And so I try to be really cognizant of things like that, of like, just checking myself, like, am I being sleazy here? Am I like, am I really being, you know, like thoughtful? Am I trying to bring something new to the conversation?
Yeah. Do you feel like there's anything that you need to have in place as a writer, creative, author, in order to go, okay, I'm going to take another risk. I'm going to pitch another thing. Like you mentioned, you know, on the sort of after you've pitched it, that you need the lawyers and the proper research, et cetera. But for you to, maybe you're at a place where you're super used to it now, but if you can kind of think back to the you that was just starting out, was it like community or daily practice, not to sound too trite about it, but like, was there anything that would support you to go, okay, I'm going to pitch again, or like maybe I've gotten a rejection, but I'm going to go again?
I definitely think for rejections, it's just about having more rejections. And, you know, the only way to get through, to get better at being rejected is just to get rejected a lot. And, you know, because sometimes you're not rejected. And, you know, I mean, like, it's kind of like how my dating life has gone. Like, I think of people that I should have asked out that so clearly were interested in me, or I could have found out instead of pining after them as a teenager one way forever, that now I would have been like, hey, do you want to like go get a coffee or something, that would feel so low stakes to me now. And so, yeah, I think for like work rejection, the only way to get better at it is just to keep putting yourself out there and to, you know, do a good job, and just to understand that, like, yeah, sometimes you get rejected and sometimes you don't, and you get better at dealing with it. I think for like daily practices and stuff, treating writing as my job, like, not that I necessarily have this like super intense, like 9 to 5 and I allot this much time for lunch. Like, I like the fluidity of working for myself and being able to, like, you know, figure out my schedule, but I treat it like a job, just in that it's like what I do every day. And, you know, I like wake up and go to work and all of that. And like, you know, what that looks like and what I'm working on might change, but I treat it as like a full-time endeavor. I think community is helpful in different ways. I think it's really nice for me to have other writer friends that I can like vent with, that, you know, there's like shorthand, that totally understand. But I also think it's really valuable to have people in my life who are not writers. I think that there's an easy tendency, especially in somewhere like New York, where you can have a very intense micro community of like-minded people to kind of only have those people in your life. And that can be really rewarding. But then I think it can be really nice to have people that like you're not talking about your work with. Or, you know, like I have friends from yoga or that I'd go to dance class with, and we'd have this connection that was way more just about like a physical, spiritual kind of connection that wasn't about like me being heady or what I thought about the news or the latest scandal. And that was really valuable to me too.
Yeah. It's funny because mine's like the opposite over the last few years. I've been like, oh my God, I can't talk to more people in the spiritual wellness coaching world.
Yeah. And I think it's good to know when you need to not talk about that stuff, when you need a break. And yeah, it's really nice for me not to have friends, especially when I'm in the middle of like writing something and it's very just like kind of just in my head and what I'm thinking about, going out with people and having dinner and talking about like, you know, their family drama or dating or like this restaurant they went to or, you know, movies or whatever, like you has nothing to do with all the stuff that's like floating in your head.
Absolutely. So that's important. How I feel. It's like, what are you watching on TV? You know, like if I'm sitting with spiritual people and I don't want to hear about their business or their marketing or their practice or their retreat they went on, I'm just like, I am dealing with those conversations so much. Like, let's talk about.
Yeah, it feels like you're at work.
Yeah. But it's funny because I found that people in the spiritual wellness world, like there isn't always a differentiation. Some of the people that I've hung out with that are a little bit more well known there, I feel like there is, because there's a little bit more of almost like hanging out with a celebrity that they're not going to talk about their latest album at dinner.
Or it's like more corporatized, which I mean in the best way possible, where it's like their assistant is doing some scheduling stuff. Like it's really hard when you're in the throes of, you know, running your own kind of small business or whatever, where there's just like every little thing is on you and you're dealing with all of it. And I think for someone who's more successful too, they're probably not dealing with every little thing. And so there's probably time in their brains to like, you know, deal with other things too.
Yeah.
Like they're not just in like triage crisis mode.
Right. Exactly. Of being like, okay, what's the next thing? And I'm going to make this. And I mean, it's interesting. I think part of it when I left LA.
Young writers can be a little bit that way, where it's like their heads are always, they're like, I want to write about this and this and that. And it's like, I don't want to be in your head right now. Like,
I
want to just have dinner and talk about this steak and like what you watched on TV and like who you slept with or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Part of leaving LA for me was like, I can't have another one of these conversations about Instagram or, you know, your following.
I mean, that's LA. LA is a company town in every way, whether it's, you know, the company
wellness or
film or whatever. And yeah, it can be hard to get out of that.
Yeah. Well, gosh, thank you for going a few minutes over. I just realized. But I love chatting with you about all of this.
Oh, I could talk to you forever.
I know. Is there anything else that you want to share? Or can you? I mean, I will say Marissa has some great books. Go read them, especially if you, like me, need a break from your self-help. Healing, you know, line up. It's like shift your mind a little bit. Read about these powerful women. Also, it's inspiring to read about the head of Weight Watchers or Glossier. These women have had the audacity to be really fucking brave and try new things. And I think that that's also a big deal, you know.
And it's me writing it. It's not like some dry business writer guy. Like it's informed with someone who's interested in these sort of like larger spiritual questions and interested in people. So there's a lot of nuance there. But I'm excited. Now I'm just in the world of Jane Birkin and, you know, having daddy issues, being a fashion icon and aging in public and all of these things. So
Please listen to the album Melody Nelson.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
While you're walking around Paris, like maybe you just had a nice glass of wine or something,
Just
yeah, I mean, that's kind of what my life has been like. Yeah,
okay, well, I'm going through the street listening to Melody Nelson for me.
Well, you know, there's a Serge Gainsbourg museum that just opened. They tore his old house. It just opened like a month ago, like you were deep in birthland. But they you know, with Charlotte Gainsbourg and like the government or whatever, they turned his house perfectly preserved. And then there's like a museum across the street. So, you know, you can see his old like naked photo of like Brigitte Bardot, and the house is all black walls and everything. So you can get the full experience.
Okay. I'm going next time I'm in Paris for sure. I think I hear my baby crying.
Okay.
Okay. It could deal with that.
Yeah. it's so good to see you and just like, good to celebrate see you. Too. And, I will always appreciate being written about at least once in my life in the New York Times, just because I have that.
At least once, probably more.
Let's hope for more. Have that New Yorker in me who like, and that artist who is like, that's one of the publications that I most admire. And I appreciate that.
Thank you.
That we got, and that you trusted me back then to do a session with you that was super vulnerable. And I miss doing that kind of close work with people, because after the pandemic, I'm mainly just working with people on Zoom or in retreats. I get to do that level of work, but we caught each other at a particular time where it was like, wow, I was in a room with women. They were like on a table at times. Like I was able to touch and be close, and that felt it feels special to have shared that moment in the context of everything we've gone through the last few years, with not being able to, you know, really have that closeness. So hopefully more in the future.
I can't wait.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Before you go, I want to offer you some questions for contemplation, integration, and writing if you wish. The first one is to consider, was there something in today's episode that touched you or moved you? Or triggered you? An image, an idea, a story? Take a moment and just think about it. Is there anything that provoked you, that reached inside of you, that perhaps brought up a memory or an idea from your life? What in this episode inspired you? Was there something that surprised you, that stood out for you? Could you jot it down just to remember? Maybe it was a concept or something that the guest said that brought you to some new awareness. Was there something about this episode that upset you, that provoked you, that pissed you off? Giving yourself full permission to dive into that. Was there anything about this episode that soothed your soul, that helped you feel a little bit more belonging, a little bit more at home, a little bit less like you're the only one? Taking those questions into your heart or into your journal or into your day. If anything stood out that you want to share with me, please do so on social media, direct into my DMs. I would love to hear what touched you, what moved you, and what you're taking from this time together. And if this episode truly inspired you in some kind of way, share it with a friend. Like, subscribe, and write a review. It means a lot to me. Thank you. So happy you're here with me, daring to feel.